welcome everyone to the XCast X-Files Podwatch, episode 61. This episode covers the beginning and drive, the very beginning of season 6. I am Tony Black, your host, and joining me for this beginning, this new beginning almost, after the Fight the Future, the X-Files movie, is Darren Mooney. Hi, Darren.
Hello, I can barely see you, it's so bright out. And there's so much desert.
There's so much desert and so much sunlight, and like it's like it's a new world.
I can't believe it's the same country.
Oh my god! I mean, it's funny because I watched these episodes today with my fiance, who hasn't really watched the X-Files properly yet, and I had to point out to her that this looks a lot sunnier, doesn't it, than the episode you have seen before? And she was like, "What? What?" She's like, she really couldn't understand it. She was like, "This is a lot of sunshine." I said, "Yeah, yeah. This is what happens when Los Angeles comes calling," which we'll talk about. So yeah, we might as well just get straight into talking about the beginning, which is the sixth season premiere of The X-Files, which first aired on November the 8th, 1998, was written by Chris Carter and directed by old favourite Kim Manners. And this very much picks up from the Fight the Future, The X-Files movie, by having a gestating EBE running around Arizona, Phoenix, Arizona, because now they can do deserts, while Mulder and Scully have to try and account for everything that went on in Antarctica, although they don't explain for at least 2.5 seasons how the hell they got back without a snowplow, or with a snowplow that had no gas in. But
they,
we'll get to that.
They don't even explain then. They just acknowledge that it's a problem and move along quickly.
They don't, yeah. When they really probably should have frozen to death or hitched a lift on that UFO. But there you go.
That would be a rather disappointing conclusion to David Duchovny and Gillian Anderson's contract negotiations, wouldn't it?
That would have been brilliant, wouldn't it? Well, that's how they really should end the entire show. Just have them sail off on a UFO. That would be very fitting, wouldn't it?
Well, I Want to Believe sort of tried that with its end of credit scene where they sail off in a boat.
That's true. That is true. But in this case, they they've got the FBI stymieing their attempts to get back the X-Files, which have been reopened, obviously, at the end of Fight the Future. They're at the same time hunting down this EBE. You've got the cigarette smoking man and all his cronies on the hunt, and you've got Gibson Praise back from the end. The super psychic alien child, and all this combines into a season premiere, which is kind of, I do quite like the beginning, Darren, but it's a bit of a, it's like the epilogue, isn't it, to Fight the Future. It doesn't really feel like an episode in its own right, does it?
No, it actually feels more like it's trying to make sense of the fact that, like, you went from the end to Fight the Future, which is, I remember, and I think I talked about this on the podcast, because I covered the end as well there. It was, basically, the end is an interesting, it's not necessarily a good episode, but it's an interesting episode, and it segues in very little way into Fight the Future, in that you have a whole bunch of stuff that happens in the end that has no impact whatsoever on Fight the Future. Obviously, you have the X-Files close, and that's a big deal, but you have stuff like, you have the character of Fowley, you have the character of Spender, you have the character of Gibson Praise, you have all this stuff that happens in the season 5 finale, which is not touched upon or explored in Fight the Future in any way, shape, or form. And then you have all the stuff in Fight the Future, which is like, oh, by the way, we're doing Alien now, with like a gestating alien that looks absolutely nothing like the EBEs that you've expected from Little Green Men and Dwayne Barry and so on and so forth. And like, one of the things I like about the beginning is, and I don't think it's a great episode, but I think it's one of the better season premieres that the show did, is that it actually goes to the effort of like trying to reconcile and trying to fit these things together. So you have like, you have them dealing with the fallout both at the end of season 5 and of the feature film, and trying to sort of like synthesize them into something that makes sense. And I mean, you even have that with, say, for example, the revelation that the giant monstrous alien creature from Fight the Future is actually like a gestating form of the traditional Little Green Man, which basically completes the alien life cycle from the black oil through to like what you would expect a Little Green Man to look like. And like, it's not the most elegant of fixes. It doesn't explain why the black oil behaves completely different in each of the 3 major appearances before this point. But it does sort of show a sense of like trying to synthesize it and trying to tie it all together. And I think you get that later on in the season as well, with like 2 fathers and 1 son, where there's a sense the writers are kind of trying to bring it all together in some ways. And I like that the beginning despite the fact that it's called The Beginning, in some ways sort of feels like it's moving towards an end game in some small way, shape, or form.
It's sort of a transition, isn't it? Because I get the impression that they, by this point, had started to think that they're gonna wrap this up, you know, in Two Fathers, One Son, and they're gonna start bringing this all together. And I think, you know, it's a necessary episode. You know, you couldn't have started the episode with Drive, obviously. You know, you couldn't have started the season, I mean, with Drive. You know, you had to have that episode that sort of bridges the movie and the new season. But it is a bit of a necessary evil. It's interesting, I think, in the sense, and you may know this where I don't, Darren, but has there ever really been a TV show that has ever done this before in terms of ending on a completely different story with a certain set of characters, doing a movie that doesn't really continue that story, but continues the overarching mythology, and then come back to the TV show, which does both. It sort of functions as a sequel to the season finale and the movie. I don't think there's ever been a TV show that's done that before, and maybe even since.
I certainly can't even think of it in terms of that sort of structure. The closest I can think is the old 1960s Batman, where they actually filmed the movie before the first season and released it after the first season. So you had this sort of weird connection where, like, it was this relic from before they started doing this weekly, and they just stuck it in the middle. But it's a completely different ballgame from what they're trying to do now. Like, I mean, even The Simpsons is probably the only other example of, like, when I'm thinking of, like, running television shows that released cinematic, and this is like a blockbuster. This was released in the middle of summertime. Like, doing that in the middle of a run, like producing 20 odd episodes of television a year is exhausting, and then trying to do a movie on top of it is even more daunting, and trying to do it in such a way that, like, this obviously Fight the Future is produced before the fifth season was produced, so trying to can make all of those dots connect up. Like, I think that this stage of the show has some serious problems. The mythology sort of has its own issues at this point. But I admire, like, the sheer guts and the sheer ambition. And the fact that it hangs together okay. Like, the fact that it coheres. And the fact that you're right when you say this is a necessary evil. Because this is basically tying or stitching all of those elements together. Because I think one of the issues of the fifth season is that it kind of goes off the reservation at points. Where, like, the Red and the Black and Patient X, they feel like they're completely unrelated to the feature film. And then you have basically, like, at the sixth season, they have to sort of process that and go, okay, well, how do we reconcile what we were planning to do with the fifth season in the break between the fourth and fifth season and what we actually did? And that's how you end up with The Beginning. And I mean, yeah, it's not a great episode of television. It's not a great episode of The X-Files, but it does what it needs to do. And I like that it's so forthright about it. Like, you pointed out that they use the desert because they can now. But, like, the opening teaser of the show is almost, like, in your face, like, daring fans to sort of rebel and just, sort of, like, punch the air and curse the production team. Because it basically opens on this wonderful shot of the sun shining brightly over the desert. It's like, we couldn't do this before. This is what the show is now. We're not trying to hide it any way, shape, or form. And you're like, I kind of admire the kind of the chutzpah involved in that. The sheer, like, unrelenting sort of, we know what we're doing, and we're doing it.
Yeah, we're not even going to try and kid you anymore. We're not even going to lie. You know, and we know, that we've moved from Vancouver. You know, we're in Los Angeles now. We can convincingly pull off a desert, unlike in Anasazi, where we had to, like, paint a lot of rocks red and then hope nobody noticed it was a bit chilly. Now we can...
Which, again, I admire the ambition of.
Yeah, it really looked okay. I mean, as a young man, it fooled me enough. I didn't really particularly question it, because at that time I wasn't questioning those insights. But when I watch it back now, you can sort of see it, but at the same time you can't. You know, they did very well. But in this case, they really enjoy, you know, and Drive next, which we'll talk about in a minute, again, taps into the idea of being able to use these locations a bit more, you know, and it's at least they wear it on their sleeve. And, you know, I do quite like The Beginning. I mean, it's fine. It has all of the characters in it. It has all the ongoing storylines. You know, it has some good moments between Mulder and Scully, some good conflicts, you know, the whole idea that Scully can't prove what Mulder wants her to prove after the Arctic, and, you know, that... The final reveal as well, I have their DNA, they've got the junk DNA thing, which, you know, when he says, well, that would mean that he's alien. He goes, it would mean we all are, you know, little things like that, you know, which are nice little, it satisfies my mythology lover, this kind of episode, because it does make an attempt, as you said earlier, with things like the, you know, the hatching EBE, it makes an attempt to try and make it fit. So, as a season premiere, it's fine. It's fine. It does the job. And then it sets up the season, mirroring season two, really, where they're off the X-Files, you know, and they've got to report to a new boss and, you know, they're going to have to fight to get back what they had. And that's the first half of the season, really, isn't it? You know, up until One Son.
And it's a wonderfully sort of, again, this is one of the things where you look at it and you wonder, like, the sheer cojones involved in this decision-making, right? Which is basically, at the end of the fifth season, Duchovny and Anderson's contracts were up. They negotiated with them. They managed to bring them back. They managed to get a two-year extension for Duchovny and Anderson as well. I think she had to sign an extension later on when Duchovny negotiated for his eighth season. But basically, they managed to get them back. But there's always a sense that Duchovny was sort of on the verge of leaving the reservation. And basically to say, well, look, at the start of the sixth season, we're going to do a whole half season about how the X-Files is not really about the X-Files. It's actually about what Mulder and Scully are doing this week. That takes a lot of guts, because I think you could argue that a lot of the issues maybe that happen later on when the show has to transition away from Duchovny are down to like the difficulties, the decisions that, well, they have to make in the second season because of Anderson's pregnancy, but the ones that they make by choice here, which is basically to say the X-Files is still the X-Files without the actual X-Files, so long as you have David Duchovny and Gillian Anderson. And you're looking at going, do you guys not realize that maybe David Duchovny isn't thinking he'll be around much longer?
Yeah. Exactly. That ties quite neatly into the next episode, Drive, because Drive is one of those episodes where Mulder and Scully are off doing something else, and then they end up happening upon something paranormal, and they run with it. You know, Drive was... first aired on November 15th, 1998, was written by Vince Gilligan and directed by another stalwart, Rob Bowman, who just directed the... Well, not just, because it had filmed a while back, but Rob Bowman directed the movie. So Drive is one of those stories where everything looks really good. It's just... It's a really good episode where Mulder ends up... You know, they're going to the Southwest in order to investigate boring domestic terrorism routine stuff. And then they happen upon a news channel report which shows a very inexplicable death. And when Mulder investigates, he soon finds himself in a Speed the movie style scenario where he has to keep driving while being held hostage by a man called Patrick Crump, who, as Scully begins to investigate, may have some sort of be the victim of some sort of strange testing involving the mind and. Basically has to try and stop the guy's head exploding. And when you put it like that, it sounds a bit silly, but it's actually a really good, tense, interesting episode.
I like that you tried to make it sound vaguely scientific and reasonable, and then sort of just, you gave up halfway through. You're like, okay, so Scully discovers that there's a resonance frequency that, look, his head's going to explode.
His head's going to blow up, that's all you need. That is it, basically. I mean, there's even that scene where Scully goes to the Navy, I think it is, and she says, theoretically, what could cause the, how could this affect like someone, and the guy gets classified. In other words, we don't know. It just is. Yeah. His head's just gonna blow up. All right.
Don't
just
question
run with it.
Yeah. Or drive with it.
Just drive with it, yeah. But it is, I think you described it in your book actually, opening the X-Files, shameless plug. As kind of like a sort of neo sort of modern Western kind of episode, you know, and the kind of things that Vince Gilligan was tapping into, which I think is absolutely spot on. It really has that level to it, doesn't it? That it's quite a tense episode, and a lot of it's about masculinity and all kinds of things like that.
It is. Well, it's this wonderful thing. Like, the obvious point here is the point to Breaking Bad, because obviously it stars Bryan Cranston, and the fact that Bryan Cranston, this was the appearance that got him the role in Breaking Bad, because a lot of people knew him as the dentist from Seinfeld. And it's like, I don't think the dentist from Seinfeld is going to convincingly play like Mr. Chips does Scarface. They're like, okay, well, how about this tape? And I mean, but even in terms of like the way it's shot, the use of the desert location, like one of the things that I like about Gilligan as a writer is that he understands genre very well. And I think all the X-Files writers do, to be honest. I think that Carter does very well. I think Morgan and Wong do very well. I think Darren Morgan does very well as well. But like, he understands that you can do things with television that you can't do with film and you can't do in other media. Like, for example, this episode opens with a fake newscast, which is very clever and sort of sets the tone for what he's going to do later on with X-Cops, where he sort of plays with the format a little bit and tweaks it. But you also have this thing where The episode is very literally about the push west, and you sort of described it as a western. It very much is a western, in that it's about these two guys in a car who are trying to journey, like it's the ultimate American journey, which is like you're pushing through the continent towards the west, towards the unyielding Pacific Ocean. And it's telling, like, the final scene of the film is basically Mulder running out of west. It's this fear that I think runs through a lot of American pop culture, and that runs through, it's sort of runs through here, which is the idea that, like, at some point, when you keep pushing through the frontier, when you keep sort of charting and driving ahead, no matter how hard you drive yourself, no matter how hard you push yourself, you're eventually going to meet something that will stop you, and something you can go no further. And what happens when that happens? Okay, occasionally your head explodes, but maybe not literally, but it does. It has this sort of rich quality to it, and it's so simple. I mean, you mentioned Speed, which is obviously the sort of the point of reference on this. I think Gilligan himself has argued that he wasn't plagiarizing Speed, thank you very much. He was plagiarizing an episode of Homicide: Life on the Street, in which Vincent D'Onofrio, I think, gets stuck under a train. I think it won a bunch of Emmys. He gets stuck under a subway car, and they have to like track down his wife or whatever before he dies. But he's a really unpleasant individual, as you might imagine, being played by Vincent D'Onofrio. I love Vincent D'Onofrio, but he doesn't really do cuddly that often. And you have that sort of wonderful quality here where you have, like, Crump is such a fantastic creation. I mean, in terms of writing and in terms of Cranston's performance. He's just such a... And you talk about masculinity there. He is this sort of... There's this interesting thing that happens when the show moves from, like, moves from Vancouver to LA. And it doesn't... It's not conscious. It's not a clear, like, the line drops or the gavel drops and all of a sudden we're doing this. But, like, in the early seasons... The X-Files tend to treat other as like a race thing. So you'd have episodes like Fresh Bones or El Mundo Gira or Teso Dos Bichos, where you would have like this idea that people from different countries or different backgrounds are like coming to the country and they're bringing weird stuff with them, and it's alien. And it's a little uncomfortable to watch now. It's a little bit awkward in this day and age. But I think then what happens is you get this sense of otherness that sort of changes when you move to Los Angeles, where it stops being... It's less obviously about race. Now, I mean, obviously Badla is sort of the you know, butt-dwelling Indian mystic in the room here, but you do have this sort of emphasis on social class that happens. So, like, with this episode, there's a great scene where, like, Crump very clearly distrusts Mulder because he's Oxford-educated and because he suspects that his ethnicity may be a certain type of ethnicity. And there's also, like, later on, you have episodes like Thief, which is about a guy who can't read, who's, like, angry at this educated rich doctor who basically took his daughter's life. And, I mean, even in Badla, for example, you have this idea of the butt-dwelling Indian mystic going undercover as a janitor. Or, for example, Salvage, where you have this guy who's affected by an experiment but is really just a working-class guy, or any number of other examples. But you sort of have this nice pivot here where... Like, Crump is a fascinating creation. Like, he's just so...
Yeah.
He's a character you should hate. And to be honest, there are points in the episode where you do hate him, because he's not a nice man. But the situation he's in, he's so fleshed out. He becomes so real. And he becomes so genuine. And he becomes... You feel for him. Like, you have a real genuine sympathy for him. And I think that's a credit to Gilligan as a writer, but to Cranston as a performer.
I mean, you know, there's numerous... You know, points of anti-Semitism tapping into this, you know, heretofore not really delved into idea that Mulder's got a level of Jewish heritage in him, which they don't really do very much with on the X-Files, but it's used as a kind of way to show Crump being quite, you know, racist, anti-Semitic and that kind of thing. So in theory, he's not a nice guy, but he has a reason behind why he's so desperate, you know, and what happened to his wife and everything like that. And he is a victim, you know, he's one of those classic X-Files victim characters of a, you know, an unfeeling, you know, higher power, in this case a government, who are doing these tests and not caring about, you know, the effect on people. You know, when Scully's going off and investigating and doing all the Scully stuff, and she finds the deaf woman in the, you know, and it's a really creepy scene. All that stuff in the forest, when she's, oh my God. I mean, and it's Mark Snow's score is phenomenal throughout the whole this, because he manages to really find a theme that really, really gets under your skin. So all that Scully stuff is great, you know, when she's going off investigating, but she finds this deaf woman, and that sort of undersells the idea that whatever these radio frequencies are doing, it's all about sound waves, it's all about frequencies, it's all about, you know, stuff that no human can do anything about. You know, you're completely at the mercy of this if these people choose to do it. So he plays that desperation really well. And then, of course, it's got that quite bittersweet ending where it's all for nothing in a way, really. And that's when Mulder gets to the, finally reaches the end. You know, there's that line, isn't it, that he says, we're running out of West. And then when they finally get to the ocean, Mulder's just disconsolate, isn't it? Because he knows that a man and his wife have... Yeah, and that they've lost their lives. And what for, really? It sells the idea, doesn't it, by the end?
It really does. And I mean, one of the things about Gilligan as a writer is that he has his own sort of preoccupations. Like, one of the fascinating things when you watch The X-Files is to try and figure out what each writer sort of deems to be, like, the personification or embodiment of evil. Like, how do they think evil works in the world? So, like, Carter sees it maybe as the black oil or as, like, this sort of possessive spirit or that sort of stuff. It tends to come up a lot where stuff passes from person to person. Whereas, on the other hand, Morgan and Wong tend to treat evil as something that is innate, something that comes from within people. With Gilligan, evil tends to be a bit more banal. It's these people who don't really care. So, and you see that a lot with, say, Breaking Bad, where, like, the big problem with Walter White is that he doesn't really care about anybody but his own sense of aggrandize and entitlement and what he believes he deserves. And, like, even here, there's this idea of, like, indifference. You pointed out the fact that, like, the government's not trying to experiment on Crump. They just happen to not care about what happens to him. And even, like, stuff like the scenes with Kirsch that sort of bookend the episode, where you have this discussion about, like, Crump's life coming down to a matter of billing. Like, the final scene, there's the bit where Mulder gets out of the car and he takes off the tie. And it sort of ties into this idea that Kirsch is trying to grind Mulder down by making him do menial and sort of pathetic work and trying to basically use the system against Mulder in a way that isn't like, oh, by the way, we'll burn him alive in a boxcar. It's like, no, what we'll do is we'll actually, like, put a wave of pressure on him, make him, like, hate his job, hate his life, try to basically use... And it's kind of interesting because Gilligan's described himself as a conservative or more conservative than many of his contemporaries, but there's an interesting, like, anti-capitalist theme that runs through some of his stuff. So you can see it in, like, Folie à Deux earlier in the fifth season, and you see it again later on in Monday, later in the sixth season, which is this sense of, like... There's a sense at this point that Gilligan is sort of... doesn't like the idea of people going to work or going to work that they don't enjoy, where you have this idea of people just being ground down, treated as numbers, as like spreadsheets, you know, where Mulder's basic response to Kirsch is like, bill me. And Kirsch does. Kirsch bills Scully.
Because
he's such a fantastic character. I love Kirsch.
I love it when he goes, hey, well, you can always quit.
He just
says that, you can always quit. As if to say, I don't care. Just quit.
Do us both a favor. We both know how this is going to end. Because he's such a great antagonist because he's not a cigarette smoking man. He's not somebody who's like hanging out with aliens. You get the sense that even if he hadn't been directed, you don't even know if he's been directed to hate Mulder. Like, for all you know, he just doesn't like Mulder not doing his paperwork on time. And he's decided to really grind this guy down because he can. And, like, I like that sort of echoes through the episode. Because Crump's life is ruined not because anybody... Not because he upset the wrong person. Not because the government was, like, running illegal experiments to find out what this stuff did. Just because they didn't care. There was a glitch in the system and the system wasn't properly set up. And it's heartbreaking, but it's also very affecting and very human and very... It really affects me profoundly. This is probably the latest... Like, everybody has their top 10 X-Files episodes. This is probably the latest of my top 10 episodes, chronologically speaking, in the show. Like, this is one of the show's last masterpieces. Now, I think there's a lot of great stuff coming up. I think, like, the triangle is fantastic. I think there's a lot of really good stuff in the 7 and 8 seasons. But this one is, like, pretty much perfect. It's, like, it's one of those perfect X-Files episodes.
Yeah, it's a great episode. It really is. It's one of Gilligan's best. It's one of the best of a pretty good, you know, sixth season on the whole. You know, there's some really good stuff in sixth season. So, yeah, it's a winner. It's a winner. So, yeah, well, that's the beginning and drive then. That's today's Podwatch. We're going to be back. Darren, you'll be back soon, I think, talking some more X-Files. I'm not quite sure when your next one is because the encyclopedia of Podwatches sometimes eludes me.
I think I'm back later in the season, actually. I'm very, very pleased to be. I'm never too far away, Tony. I'm never too far away.
This is true. This is very true. So tomorrow we've got obviously Triangle, which you mentioned before, and Dreamland Part 1. So we've got a couple of really quirky off-the-wall episodes for you next time, which are a little bit different from these two. So, as ever, just remember you can find us at @X_cast and on Twitter and at the X-Files Basement on Facebook. So look us up there and find us on iTunes if you haven't already. Hopefully you're enjoying the Podwatch. I would say just... roughly over halfway through now, so we've still got a little bit of a stretch to go, but we've got some great stuff coming up. So continue enjoying the daily dose of X-Files, and until we return tomorrow, remember, as ever, trust no one.
So we're not running out of West then, Tony, no?
It's Mr. Black to you.